How'd you like to hang your stocking on a great big coconut tree? We're talking Christmas Island. Hit it. It was 1988. A Fish Called Wanda was number one at the box office. The U.S. stealth bomber was unveiled. Guns N' Roses needed a little patience. And Leon Redbone sent us on a tropical Christmas vacation. I'm your host, Jerry D., with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, we got it covered. Now, joining me is a very special guest. You'll know him as the host of the Holly Jolly Xmasu podcast, Scott Leopold. Scott, how's it going?
Hey, Jerry, not too bad.
Right on. So I heard you just came from bingo. Was that pretty fun, or how did that go?
It's not bad. It's fundraising for my daughter's high school. And if my voice is a little hoarse, I do the calling. So the games ran a bit long tonight, so I had to talk a little bit more than I normally do.
I gotcha. Yep. I completely understand. I've been there with some of my gigs before, cause I'm also a musician. And so, whenever our church is doing fundraisers, I usually end up having to, to kind of stretch it a little bit. And so we have like a set that, some of the other choir directors and things, and we form a little band and I have a set that we normally do, but sometimes, yeah, we're asked to just kind of make it go a little bit longer. And so we just kind of end up talking and making jokes and whatever. And by the end of it, yeah, our voices are pretty dead. Mm-hmm. So first of all, thanks for coming on the show.
But, yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, when I asked you, you gave me a couple of suggestions, but one of the ones that you really wanted to do, and I've heard you mention this actually in your podcast, is, Christmas Island by Leon Redbone. So what's your general like history and experience with it?
I remember seeing him on TV when I was a kid. I believe it was Saturday Night Live, but I'm sure it wasn't the first time he was on, because I was, three at the time.
Right.
But as the 80s started, I had an awareness of him. I knew his name. I could pick out his face and whatnot. And he's just someone who, he'd pop up on TV from time to time. But at the start of the 80s, you started getting, the Budweiser commercials, theme song to Mr. Belvedere.
Yes.
So he was a lot more prevalent than he had been. And I had to have been, 16, 17 at the time. And my mom, she always, she played Christmas music year round when we were growing up. And the thing by the 80s, though, it was the same three albums each year. It was John Denver and the Muppets, and then a couple of albums my dad had picked up at Firestone.
Yeah.
So we were in a little bit of a rut. And one night I ran to the paint store with them, and, I had my first job. I had a little pocket money. And the paint store had this rotating thing of cassettes. And one of the ones on there was Leon Redbone, which I saw that. And all I could think was, I know that guy. I like how he sounds. And that's something my mom would never buy. So I went ahead. I picked that up. I picked up Bing Crosby's tape. And we get in the car. My dad let me put it in. And it just blew me away. I mean, some of the songs are songs that I've heard before, mm-hmm. but he had just such a distinct voice and such a distinct style. It was so cool having something that was different than what we'd been listening to for years. And it was kind of like, it was like my music. It was the Christmas music I could listen to that, maybe mom didn't want to hear all the time. Mm-hmm. So that kind of... That kind of got me started on buying my own Christmas music and collecting, and that led to decades of, you know, thousands upon thousands of songs at this point.
Which is awesome. I mean, I anyone that can do that, they can just collect and collect. And I have a small collection, but, you know, it's nothing, I'm sure it's nothing compared to yours. And while yours is at least as far as your podcast goes, I know your collection is very niche. Mine is also, but in a different way, you know. I'm into the 80s, and so anything having to do with 80s. So I like the Care Bears and Pac-Man Christmas album and, you know, all those weird ones that are out there, you know, Pound Puppies and Rainbow Bright. And if they had a Christmas album, I tried to get it. But so I know what you're talking about there.
Well, and see, and one of the good things about the 80s is that by the 70s, Christmas music in America, it was the whole market had gotten kind of stale. You didn't have a lot of artists putting out too many big albums. And then What was it? The Very Special Christmas came along.
Yeah.
And that just, you know, suddenly made Christmas music cool again. And so, yeah, a lot of really good stuff came out of the 80s as far as Christmas music.
Yeah, and you're right. And ever since then, it seems like everyone that's popular tries to come up with a Christmas album, you know, at least once in their career, sometimes even, you know, two or three times. And so it really did, you're right, it really did revitalize the whole industry. Leon Redbone, you mentioned he was on Saturday Night Live, and he was on twice in that first season alone, which is kind of neat. And I vaguely remember that first season. It was, you know, same thing. It was just, I don't really recall it too much, but I do recall him seeing him on, what is it, with the Johnny Carson show?
I read something. I guess he was one of the, he was on there quite a bit. I forget how many times, but Johnny had him back quite a few times.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head. His voice is just, it's so unique. You know, like there's those artists where you hear them and like right away, you know who it is. I think Ozzy Osbourne is one. And you know, whether you like him or not, I mean, you can always tell it's Ozzy Osbourne, you know. Same thing with Leon Redbone. He's just one of those guys that not only his style, but his voice in particular, the timbre of his voice, you know, the overtones that he gets when he sings, just everything about it is just, it's so him. So much so that you know, Bob Dylan had said that if he had had his own label, if he had ever started a label, he would have signed Leon, you know, right away, which I think is really cool. You know, when Bob Dylan actually likes you enough to to plug you before you're even famous. I mean, that's saying something. But yeah, not only his voice, but his style. So he really kind of stuck with that Tin Pan Alley, you know, that era, the vaudeville kind of act. And it shows in everything that he does, but especially on this Christmas Island album, I noticed there's a lot of like dobro, there's clarinets, there's even a bass saxophone, which is really typical of that earlier style. And even the chord progressions, there's a lot of, you know, secondary dominance, like, you know, five of five of five things, you know, B7 to E7 to A7 before you finally resolve it to the one, you know, which is D, and just all these different chords, and instrumentations and everything at play that really makes his style what it is. And of course you add the guitar and the banjo and it's hard to classify, which I think for me, I would just call it eclectic, I guess.
But, yeah, well, and then, you know, you get Dr. John coming in on Frosty the Snowman, and that just, you know, that really turned it into a classic album. The first time I saw the video on MTV, it just blew me away. Not only that, hey, you know, that's my tape, they're playing one of the songs I own on there, which, you know, MTV didn't play a ton of Christmas music at the time, but they did air him and Dr. John quite a few times, so that I got a big kick out of that at the time.
See, and I missed that. I would have loved to have seen that, because I mean, again, Dr. John also has a very distinct voice. You know, it's real gravelly, and I mean, he's got that growl that's, you know, it's just, it's great, especially for the type of music that he does. But when you pair them together, they blend so well, but at the same time, you know, they're so different, but it works somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those where you don't really expect it to, and then it just, it does. And it really is magical. It's kind of neat. I really dig it. But yeah, so Leon Redbone was of Armenian descent. He was actually born Dikran Govelian. His parents were from Jerusalem, and they immigrated to Cyprus. And in the 60s, he came over to Canada, where he pretty much started gigging around and just playing his guitar. And that's kind of how he developed his persona somehow. And no one really knows how, which is kind of adds to the mystery and mystique. And I really like it. But he changed his name to Leon Redbone. And no one knows why. But he kind of developed this persona. You know, he always wore the sunglasses. He had that mustache with the, you know, sometimes he had the little soul patch going on. And he always had the black tie and what's it called? Not a fedora, the
Panama hat.
Panama hat. That's what it is. Yeah. And so, you know, he always wore that. And you can see it even on YouTube. You can find some of his performances where it's just him and his guitar. And he's singing these, you know, Tin Pan Alley style songs. It's really neat because not only does he play the chords, but of course he'll throw in some walking lines here and there, just a little riff, just to kind of fill out some of the silence. And it, I mean, it really works.
You have to love the commitment he had to the Leon Redbone character. I mean, so much so that when he died, they really didn't even know how old he was. I mean, he had stuck with it so well and for so long that the real person was still pretty much a mystery when he passed away. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think even in his obituary, it said that he was 127 years old.
Uh-huh.
That's amazing. I hope in my obituary, my family does something funny like that, but I don't think they will. You're right. He had such dedication to it. And I love that even in Elf, you know, he played Leon, the snowman, and even the snowman had the glasses and the hat and everything. And I thought that was a really cool bit.
Well, and I love the fact that, you know, as much as I liked him growing up, mm-hmm. him being an elf, that's something that, you know, my kids know. It's something their kids are going to know. So it's just another way that he's going to be, he'll carry on a lot longer than he would have otherwise.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, because I've only had, you know, some vague memories about him until then. And then all of a sudden, you know, I remember hearing him singing with Zooey Deschanel, and I thought, this is really familiar. And so then I had to go back and look him up. And sure enough, it was that guy that I remembered seeing with his guitar on stage, you know, all by himself. You know, it's such a classic that now they're going to show it. I mean, they do show it every single year, multiple times a year. During the Christmas season. And so you're right. He is going to live on, at least in Elf. And same thing, my kids love the movie. So they know Leon, even though they actually don't know the Leon Redbone character. Mm-hmm. But I think it's kind of neat because not only would he sing, I mean, he was super heavily inspired by vaudeville. And, you know, I mentioned Tin Pan Alley before, and I'll get into that in a little bit. But you know, that whole vaudevillian style of, you know, yeah, you sing some songs, then you do some comedy bits. And so he would throw in some of those comedy bits and impromptu things, you know, even claiming to have written certain songs or, you know, that that were written way before he was born. I mean, that's a great bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's one of those people that, you know, if I had a chance to go back and do it all over again, that's one of those people I'd want to see in concert.
Yeah,
I've heard his shows were something else.
Yeah, I can imagine. Honestly, I you know, it's more like an experience rather than just listening to someone get up on stage and play.
Uh-huh.
You go to a lot of some of those rock bands, especially like in the 90s and stuff with the, you know, with grunge and things like that, and it was mostly just them on stage playing. And and I kind of get it. They were trying to pare down after all the mega glam arena rock stuff, but you know, it kind of held over in a lot of rock in a lot of ways. And so I would have liked to have just gone to see a whole show and experience, you know, the performer.
And yeah, we saw Roger Daughtry a couple summers ago. He did the Tommy tour.
Ooh.
And as great as it was seeing Tommy on mm-hmm. stage, when he came out for his, for just his solo routine afterwards, it was just fantastic because he really interacted with the crowd. You know, he was a lot more personable. He was talking to people directly. So we'd seen The Who before, but mm-hmm. that experience, that was a little more special just because there's a little more of the one-on-one there.
Right, right. So it's more personal. And uh-huh. I like when artists do that. My father-in-law, he always tells about, they went to see, you know, he and my mother-in-law went to see Kenny Rogers, and he had a whole production and it was big and grand. And then like a couple of weeks later, they went to see John Denver, and it was literally just him on stage with his guitar. And they said it was like the best concert they'd ever seen, that it, you know, blew Kenny Rogers, you know, rest in peace. Just, it blew him away. And to this day, you know, they still talk about that one time they saw John Denver and it was just him and his guitar. And I know, I get it. There's something about that one-on-one that makes it, you know, it just, it hits you more because it's almost as if you're there by yourself, just talking to the guy and then just kind of having fun and playing. So, I mean, I get it, you know, it's a whole different experience.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Leon Redbone, like you mentioned, he, you know, because his past was still kind of shrouded in mystery, there was several suggestions that he was Andy Kaufman or that he was also Frank Zappa, which, as great as those suggestions are, I'm glad that he wasn't. You know, I love those guys. And Frank Zappa's out there. Some of his music is just amazing, even though it's like crazy experimental and stuff. But, you know, I mean, it's, I like that he's his own thing.
Mm-hmm. Although, to be honest, if he would have turned out to have been Andy Kaufman, I'd have been pretty excited.
That's true. And, you know, I probably wouldn't have been surprised either. But, but let's talk the album in general, Christmas Island. There's a lot of standards on there, which I think were really cool. But then there's some unexpected ones. And instrumentation, as I mentioned before, we have all sorts of things. So you have strings, clarinets, the dobro, played by Nancy Cash Dollar, which, I mean, that's a great name there, Cash Dollar. But, you know, it's all these instruments that you weren't really hearing at the time. You know, this was a time dominated by, like, synths, you know, and when you don't get the synth, something was different. So I can see how you definitely would have, you know, been perked up to hear something like that.
Well, and it wasn't, you know, that polished, you know, the, I guess the overworked studio feel that you got from a lot of stuff back then.
Right. The overproduced. Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said, he picked some songs that at least at the time you didn't really get a heck of a lot of on, if not on Christmas albums, you just didn't hear them. I mean, Toyland, that old Christmas Moon, mm-hmm. Christmas Mall Blues. They were songs I had heard before, not a lot. But hearing it from Leon Redbone, they just took on a whole new life for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and even the songs that he does, the standards, you know, White Christmas and Frosty, they all have intros that are relatively short, you know, comparatively speaking. So, you know, you hear White Christmas and you're used to that big, you know, big production, and then you hear Bing Crosby get into it, but it's literally in this version, it's just a couple of seconds and then bam, you get into the vocals. And so I remember the first time I heard it, it was very jarring actually, because I was so used to the Bing Crosby version that, you know, something didn't seem right. And I kind of like that because, I'm very eclectic in my tastes. I love jazz. Classic rock is also my favorite, and film scores. Those are probably like my top three my top three favorite genres. But when I heard this, I mean, it was almost like I had something I'd never really heard before, because, you know, I was used to listening to Metallica a lot at the time, and they have those like minute and a half long intros. So to get an intro that's only a couple of seconds long, you know, it definitely makes you go, something about it is just, it's very unique.
Yeah, well, and for me, I'd say this more than any album really set me off on trying to find more, I guess, unique sounding Christmas music. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Andy Williams is great. Bing Crosby's great. But hearing someone like Leon Redbone singing the same songs, it, it, you know, it hit that sweet spot for me. It really appealed to kind of like what you said, my more eclectic tastes, especially in Christmas music. And, you know, years later, that's when I went through a period where I was trying to find albums played on like really bizarre albums or bizarre instruments. So I've got, you know, whole albums on the theremin, glass nice. Harmonica, just all sorts of strange things. So
that's awesome. I love the theremin. I mean, it's just you, one of those, you know, you immediately think of Pet Sounds and 50s sci-fi B movies, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's great. Yeah, whenever you can get an album with a theremin on it, go for it. But, you know, he's got some like really great performers on here. I mean, they're all like very famous session players, like studio musicians. I mean, he's got John Eric Kelso on trumpet, Terry Waldo on piano. Let's see, Bobby Gordon, Dan Levinson on clarinet. Dan Levinson was, you know, I mean, he's phenomenal on clarinet. Frank Vignola on guitar. I mean, you have a ton of people. The Cindy Cash Dollar, like I said, on dobro. And then you had like John Gill, who played banjo and orchestrated all the strings. And so, I mean, when you get all these great session players, you know you're going to come up with some great sounding instruments. But something tells me that, because he produced it, something tells me that that same kind of raw, and I don't know if raw is the right word, but just the, like you mentioned, the very unpolished, that energetic kind of vibe, he probably went for. And so I doubt they actually did many takes, but I mean, that's just speculation.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I can't say, but I know they started recording tracks on December 8th, 1987 at the Manhattan Recording Company. And as I'm pretty sure, and I can't find where I read it now, but I read that it didn't take very long to get it all done. So, I mean, I think it's really neat to be able to just get the cream of the crop basically and lay down some tracks and come up with something kind of special and that's different, you know?
Yeah, well, and when you look back on it, it really does hold up now. I mean, you know, some stuff you listen to and there's plenty of albums out there that are product of their time, and it's not something you want to listen to every year, but or at all after the first couple times.
Right.
But with Leon Redbone, I mean, this is one of those albums that, you know, it's one of the first albums I listened to. Well, I can't say as I get into the Christmas music season this year, because I haven't stopped, but but most years, you know, around October or so, this is one of the first albums I normally reach for.
Nice. So the title track, actually, Christmas Island, and I want to say, I think this might be my favorite song on the album. I love the Frosty with, you know, with Dr. John, but I think this might be my favorite, you know, my favorite tune there. And it's, you know, Christmas Island. It was actually written in 1946 by Lyle Moraine, who was a struggling Hollywood actor. And since he wasn't really getting any parts, he decided, since he also played piano, to get into music. And so he wrote this song, and he kind of went back to his youth in the 20s and wrote that, you know, vaudeville style Hawaiian song, because back in the 20s, you know, it was very popular to write songs in the style of Hawaii or Hawaii inspired songs. So he kind of went to his youth and pulled it. And I mean, you got some lines like, you know, how do you like to spend Christmas on Christmas Island? You know, how do you like to spend the holiday way across the sea? And you can hear that kind of influence in even in some Bugs Bunny cartoons. I mean, that's how popular that thing was, you know. Like when Bugs Bunny stranded on that desert island with the with those other two those sailors, and they're all stuck there and they're trying to eat him. You know, it's, you get that same kind of vibe. And I mean, it's really neat. It's one of those songs that it's different. It's like when you hear Melikaliki Maka, you know, it's not your typical Christmas song. And anytime there's not a typical Christmas song, my ears perk up, because I love, like you mentioned, I love all the standards. And to me, it's not Christmas if I don't hear the standards. But at the same time, you know, I like to hear some of the different things as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
Yeah, well, and I know I've got plenty of other versions of Christmas Island, but I think Leon Redbones is the one that I first listened to, you know, on a regular basis. So that's definitely my favorite version of the song.
Yeah. Well, I know the Andrews sisters recorded it. Mm-hmm. I think what's his name? Guy Lombardo. I think he's the one that actually was their backing orchestra there. And so you're right. There's a few other versions, but anyway, Lyle Moraine passed away in 1988. So he probably didn't even get to hear Leon's version, which is a shame because I think he would have appreciated it.
Yeah, definitely. And well, and one of the things, you know, when I was listening to this again over the last few days, for me, trying to pick out a favorite is kind of difficult.
Right, right. I
mean, Frosty the Snowman, Christmas Island, No Place Like Home for the Holidays, are, I'd say, probably my top three. And then on the original release, everything else would probably tie for second. There was a bonus track on a CD re-release of Kitty Cat's Christmas.
Yeah.
And that's, I do not have talking one, about so. It.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I found out about that when they finally released it in digital format, and I downloaded that, and I don't listen to it.
It's definitely the weirdest of all of them because it starts off with the little girl, I think, and then it's almost got like a Mexican, and I don't know if it's Mexican or Spanish, but definitely a Latin flair to it. And shame on me, I should know that I'm Hispanic, but oh well. you know, it's the rhythm that he uses, the plucking and the picking. I mean, it's got that very Hispanic, you know, Latino feel, but it's just strange. I can see why he would go with something like that, you know, being Leon Redbone and all, but it didn't, at least for me, it didn't quite click.
Yeah, well, and something I never knew until about a week ago. Apparently, there was a German special edition released last year that has an alternate version of Frosty the Snowman on it.
Really?
And I did a couple quick searches. I didn't see anything, so that's something I need to keep an eye out for.
I'd be interested in hearing that, seeing what the difference is.
Yeah, so I have no idea if it, you know, is it just Leon? Is it him and Dr. John still? It definitely intrigued me.
Or if the instrumentation is different.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah, and I like that Frosty. It's, you know, of course, you got Dr. John's growl in there, you know, Frosty the Snowman. I mean, it's and that's terrible. I can't do it. But he, you know, he really kind of just blends and kind of goes with it. And that's what I think I like about that version is that, you know, they just kind of play off each other.
Well, and for years, there's a forum I get on, a Christmas music forum. And, you know, every once in a while, someone will start a thread saying, you know, what's your dream Christmas album? And for years, mine would have been Leon Redbone, Dr. John, and Tom Waits together.
Oh man, that would have been cool.
It would have been the most gravelly Christmas music ever produced.
For sure, yeah. Oh man. So, you know, I mentioned Tin Pan Alley, and of course that was a specific area in New York where a bunch of just songwriters and song publishers, they just started churning out music. And essentially they would just hire songwriters and just composers, and they would just try to their best to buy the songs from them, or sometimes they would even like put their own names on the songs, which is kind of a shame because so many people aren't remembered for the right thing. But you know, they had a style that was kind of like a mix of like ragtime and jazz and blues, and as well as some of the older operetta styles, you know, mixed in. And so it's very eclectic sound, but the thing that they prided themselves on, and I think this might be why why Leon actually kind of gravitated toward them was to have songs that anybody could sing at any time. And so they were hugely popular. Of course, the most famous would be Irving Berlin, who wrote like almost every single popular song in in that era.
Yeah, well, and that's something that I've always been fascinated by with Tin Pan Alley, is that, you know, they were churning out just such a phenomenal volume of music, mm-hmm. and they managed to create some of the just so many of the standards.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, so much of the, you know, American songbook is taken from these, you know, basically like sweatshop conditions where all they were producing was music.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I mean, they even had what they called song pluggers, which I thought was kind of neat. It was literally just musicians that the publishers hired just to play the same song or a couple of songs over and over and over again until the people, you know, learned it so well that as they were walking out, they could sing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they would sell their music, just to have people singing these songs all the time, which, I mean, when you think about it, yeah, that's pretty standard. You know, you write your song and then you hope someone buys it and, or you know, helps you produce it. But at the time, I mean, it was definitely something novel. And I mean, the scope of it all still kind of boggles my mind. That you're right. It was just these poor conditions where people were just, all right, write me some songs and we'll see how much I'll pay you. And sometimes it was just a flat fee for everything, so they never saw any royalties. And sometimes it was like, I'll buy the song, but I'm going to put my name as composer. And, you know, at least the songs were catchy, and at least a lot of them, like you said, kind of live on today, which is really nice. But I, you know, and I can see why he would be, you know, pulled towards that, just because of how accessible they were, how different they were from everything else that he was hearing. Because, I mean, his tastes especially were very eclectic. So he'd listen to everything from like Paganini to Cliff Edwards to Jelly Roll Morton, who's, you know, awesome. I love Jelly Roll Morton. Mustafa the Castrato, Jimmy Rogers, Mongolian throat singers. He would actually listen to Mongolian throat singers, which, I mean, that's crazy. Who listens to that, you know?
There was an album a couple years ago that, oh my gosh, I can't think of his name, jazz musician. He had a couple tracks with Mongolian throat singers on there. Yeah, and I can't think of the, I could look it up real quick if I remember the the translation of Jingle Bells, but it's escaping my mind.
But, I mean, he would just listen to everything. And so not only was he eclectic, but or his tastes, you know, eclectic, but you can see how all of that kind of came out in this album, because it really is a mix of instruments, you know. I mean, there was even a bass saxophone, yeah, not a Barry sax, which is more popular, you know, a bass sax, just to get some of that low end. And again, that was popular like in the 20s, but not so much anywhere else. So, I mean, it's one of those where his inspirations, I think he drew so much inspiration from that specific era that it informed everything he did. But
yeah, well, and, you know, when you think back on it, you know, he came out of the 70s, and mm-hmm. could someone like him really even be successful today? I mean, you had such a, just an odd mixture of talent in the 70s at times, mm-hmm. and not just society, but the music industry was so much different back then. The fact that he was able to get a shot and build an audience, I don't know that's something, I don't know if that's something you'd really see going on in this day and age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. There is a lot of indie music, but something in this style, I think you're right. I think it would be very difficult for him to have made it today, you know, and you have people here and there that still do well in their little thing. But, I mean, yeah, I really don't see it happening, which I would have been a shame if the world had never heard him, you know?
Yeah, well, even, you know, Hall & Oates, even if you look back on their career, they were basically, pretty unsuccessful for almost a decade. They had one hit, mm-hmm. but, you know, the label stuck with them, which is, you know, they saw it as an investment back then, and suddenly late 70s, early 80s hit, and you ended up with, you know, one of the biggest bands of the decade.
Which, sorry to go on a tangent, but did you ever watch Live at Daryl's House?
I've seen a couple episodes. I need to watch more of that.
Yeah, they were pretty great. And not even just the cooking part or whatever. I loved when they would just kind of talk about, yeah, we'll do this and do this. And then all of a sudden, you know, after like a rehearsal or two, they just kind of run through it. And I mean, it would always sound amazing. But, I love when Smokey Robinson was on there and the OJs, and the Joe Walsh episode was really good. And I know I'm getting off topic, but, you know, it's not a podcast if you don't go off topic every once in a while.
Well, I took my wife and my sister to see Hall & Oates and Tears for Fears a couple years ago.
Nice.
Oh, my gosh. You want to talk about a good concert? That, you know, we saw Weird Al a few years before that.
Oh, I love Weird Al.
And you know, that really brings out the 13-year-old in you.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
but then sitting there, and when the opening strands of Everybody Wants to Rule the World hit, oh my gosh.
Oh, I can imagine. I've never seen Tears for Fears, but I did see Hall & Oates with Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, that was a good show. But the reason, well, I won't forget it because it was a good show. But the second reason I won't forget it was that I was literally like just a row or two outside of the covered area, and it started to pour. And so I literally just pulled my cap down over my head and turned my collar up and just kind of huddled there and listened to that while the rain was just beating down on me. So, but it was a good concert. So, yeah. But anyway, sorry, back to Leon Redbone and Christmas Island. The one that I kind of really like as well was that old Christmas Moon. And I think one of his bandmates actually wrote that one.
Yeah. And that's one that really, That got to me the first time I heard the album. It was so different that that one did something for me.
The melody and everything, it does harken back to that earlier style that we talk about. But the pianist, what's his name, Waldo, was, he was also known for some of his ragtime style playing, you know, and he could do that Jelly Roll Morton type. You know, gosh, I can't think of the name now. Shame on me. I'm a musician. I should know this. You know, but like when you go back and forth and you play the bass note and then comp in the same hand, you know, you're just boom, bump, bump kind of a thing. And so he was really, really good at it. And you can kind of hear, that in this tune, you know, you have that, oh, that old Christmas moon, you know, the way I'm no Leon Redbone, so I can't sing it like that. But just something about it. It's like in that style that you can just see the guys huddled around like a piano, just singing and just having a good time, you know. But this one's really neat because and I like when songs do this kind of stuff, but they get a little bit harmonically inventive there, because in the chorus they hit the four chord. And then they hit the minor four chord, which, you know, so like they go in the key of D, they're playing a G, and then all of a sudden they'll go to G minor. And of course that B flat is not in the key of D. And so it just adds a little bit of extra dimension to the song. But then instead of resolving it to anything that you would think they'd resolve it to, they just resolve it down to the tonic, which is D. And so you get that B flat going down to A, the G going down to the F sharp. And so it's almost like a suspension, which I think is really cool. I mean, it's neat stuff that he did there. And then, of course, we get some more of the secondary dominance with like E7 to A and things like that. Yeah, it's a great tune there. And I know what you mean about it speaking to you. There is a couple of lines here and there that are not my favorite lines, but musically, I really enjoy it. But yeah, I think as an album, everything really works for me. Like there's a nice flow to it because you kind of have the standards, but then suddenly you kind of go into you know, he keeps some of the ones that aren't as popular. He keeps those towards the end. And I kind of like that. Of course, we go White Christmas and then straight into Winter Wonderland. And then from there, we get into the Frosty. So you have right away all these songs that just kind of flow nice and easy. And I just kind of really enjoy the flow of the album as a whole.
Yeah. And you know, I put together a CD for my friends and family each year. So it's something I always try to pay attention to is having a good flow of songs. And the whole arrangement of the tracks on this album, I mean, like you said, you start with the standards, you get into some of the more obscure stuff, and then he brings it back to a couple of the standards at the end. Mm-hmm. So
except for Kitty Cat's Christmas. we won't speak of that one.
Hey, as long as I stick with my old cassette, or if I get the vinyl, we should be fine.
yeah, there you go. Yeah, Christmas Ball Blues is pretty cool. I really enjoy that one too. But yeah, I think something about the arrangements, and you know, as we talked about, just the stripped down, just raw versions of the standards, I think is really cool, because it does remind me. I mean, I go caroling with my family every year, and so it does remind me of just being with my brothers, and you know, my dad's playing guitar and I'm playing guitar, and you know, we just kind of, there'll be sleigh bells and of course things, you know, just various instruments, but you kind of get that live feel, which I really like. And I like when bands can do that without actually having to do like a live, you know, a live record. Mm-hmm. Generally so many times when I hear the live records, they're just because they're taken live, and nowadays it's different. You can take it from the actual, you know, master tracks, but generally they were never really mixed very well. They tried to put the audience in so that, you know, it's live, and it just, it always felt so artificial and badly produced, but not in like an overly produced way, just in a, you know, just it, no one did their job kind of a thing. And there's very few live albums that I've really enjoyed. But here, when a band, and in this case, the artist and his, you know, his session musicians, when they can capture that feel of actually being there, I think there's that, and I hate to use the word energy again, but I mean, that's what it is. There's this energy and this vibe that you just really get into, and it really brings you into that room where they are playing. And I think he did it so well. And I know it was, you know, him and his manager that just pretty much produced it all. So he was kind of a genius when you think about it.
Well, and you also have to think for as quickly as they recorded the album, I mean, that's got to play a part in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they had spent, you know, weeks, you know, rehearsing and playing the same songs over and over again, I don't think you'd had quite the same feel.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm sure they'd fix different things, but I know he was also very notorious for during his concerts, you know, changing up set lists. so it kind of makes me wonder like what else he kind of changed up as they were playing, you know, like, no, let's do this. And then you just, okay, all right, we'll lay it down. Let's lay down this one track. And you know, then, okay, no, let's try this and then see what else happens. but I can imagine how that would be very frustrating for one of his musicians that he toured with. But I know you mentioned that, you know, Christmas Island and then Oh Christmas Moon, or, you know, some of those are your favorite. Is there anyone that is your least favorite aside from Kitty Cat's Christmas?
I'd say outside of Kitty Cat's Christmas, you know, the first time I heard it, Toyland just, you know, it's what, probably the slowest song on the mm-hmm. the album.
Yeah, it is.
It you know, as a teen, that's probably the one that I skip through the most often.
Yeah, I gotcha.
I enjoy it now, but you know, 30 years ago, it wasn't. It definitely wasn't my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. Same here. I love all sorts of jazz, but like the bebop, you know, hard bop and that kind of thing are my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever they'd get into one of the slower songs, I'd usually just kind of, you know, turn the track or, you know, just go to the next one just so I could hear more of that up-tempo stuff that I really, really enjoy. And so I kind of actually felt the same way with Toyland back in the day. But it's one of those where I don't know if it's just because I'm older, but, or, you know, more mellow, but it kind of speaks to the child in me now. And I really, really like it. And I think it's actually one of my favorites on the on the whole album, which is something I never thought I'd say.
Well, and I think for me, you know, it's not a song I heard a lot back then, but since mm-hmm. then, I'm sure I've got probably a couple hundred versions of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more I hear other people singing it, it definitely brings up Leon Redbone's version in comparison. So I think that helped my appreciation of it grow a bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny how much different a song can sound at 48 as opposed to 18.
Yeah, for real. Yes. I want to get into the lyrics really quickly. Go back to Christmas Island, just because I really like this this one verse here where he says, "If you ever spend Christmas on Christmas Island, you will never stray, for every day your Christmas dreams come true." That's kind of a neat thing to think about, when your Christmas dreams come true. And not just, you know, as a kid, it's all about the presents, but especially now as a dad, I mean, I think my biggest Christmas dream is just to be with my family, you know, and just to make sure that we're all happy and together, and whether or not we're on an island, I mean, that's just, it's a great sentiment. And so I really, really like this song.
Well, and that's something for me. The as I've gotten older, I've always been more into the giving than the getting as far as gifts go. Mm-hmm. And we had a couple years ago where I told my wife, I was like, you know, don't give me anything. Don't have me ask. Don't have me come up with a list. Just don't give me anything. Let me get up on Christmas morning and just enjoy everyone else watching, or enjoy watching everyone else open the gifts.
Nice.
And I'll tell you, that was one of the best Christmases I've ever had. There was no pressure. I didn't have to worry about, you know, going out and making sure I'd bought gifts for myself as well. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, sitting back and watching the kids have their Christmas. And so
that's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I know for me growing up, it was all about the getting, I'll be honest. I wish I could say that I was more like you, but no, it was, I wanted the presents. but yeah, you're absolutely right. More and more, I like the simple things, and it's, you know, it's just drinking hot chocolate and watching the excitement on the kid's face. And so when I hear something like that, you know, every day your Christmas dreams come true. I mean, it's just one of those that it's one of those lines that kind of, you know, it cuts to the heart of it, you know? And so I really enjoy this. And of course, singing, and when you hear him singing it in his baritone voice, that's, you know, just there's kind of a roughness there, even though it's also smooth, which is, it's a weird juxtaposition. Something about it, it really warms your heart. And I don't know what else to say. And I know I've said it a couple of times already, but it's just, it's really cool. And I really love this album now.
Well, and as far as that line in particular, I think that plays kind of into the same sort of feeling that you get, you know, when you're watching whichever version of Christmas Carol, and the whole idea of keeping Christmas every day of the year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to have a Scrooge-a-thon each year where we get up in the morning and we start watching. We've got too many copies of Christmas Carol now to get through all of them in a day.
Right, yeah.
You know, we'll start with like the 1910 version and get all the way up through Scrooged, or Albert Finney, or, you know, whichever, wherever our endurance finally gets the best of
us. As much as you can take, yeah. That's a cool tradition there. That's really neat. I know what you mean. That in Scrooged, when Bill Murray at the very end is doing his crazy rant, you know, and he's just saying, you know, you'll get greedy for it, you know, and all that, you know, about that Christmas feeling. That's another moment that you mentioned, that it really just speaks to you, and just it does encapsulate with that one particular line. Mm-hmm. So I got to ask, Scott, what would you say, if you could pinpoint it, if not, you know, just try your best or give me a general, but what would you say would be your happiest moment or memory with this album?
It has to be that, you know, that first night right after I got it, sitting in the car with my dad, freezing cold out, and putting in the cassette player the first time. And, you know, just hearing, you know, hearing the start of White Christmas and just realizing that this was so different. And this was, you know, it was my music. It was, you know, it wasn't the stuff mom listened to. It wasn't the stuff you heard on the radio. It was just the kind of stuff I've been looking for. And mm-hmm. it thrilled me. So that has to be my best memory of this album.
Nice. Yeah. For me, it would be going back after watching Elf and, you know, I kind of recognized like, wait a minute, this guy sounds familiar, and going back and then discovering the album again after that, you know, hearing it with like fresh ears, knowing that, now he, it was a snowman to be singing now, you know, which is terrible, but yeah, I think it was that going back and rediscovering the album after hearing it so many years earlier. And there was something special because at this point, or at that point, you know, I had already studied music. And so now I can appreciate the music in a new way rather than just kind of like, oh, this doesn't sound like Genesis, you know, because it really didn't. So yeah, I think that I would say that would be mine. But yeah, it's one of those albums that is at least for me, it took me a while to appreciate, even though I knew something was different, you know, that first time I heard it, it really did take me all that time to appreciate it. And now that I've appreciated it, and now that I know what it's trying to do musically, I mean, it brings me to a whole new level of respect for it. But now we come to my favorite part of the show, which is a little segment I like to call Gag Me with a Spoon. So this is where we do our best impression of our least favorite part of of the album here. So I'll put it up to the listeners to vote and see who has the best worst impression. And as a guest, I'll let you go first. Just kind of, you know, set up the, not the scene, but, you know, set up the moment for us.
Yeah, well, and I thought about doing Kitty Cat's Christmas. I have not listened to that enough to even, I can't even make an attempt. I tried finding the lyrics, didn't have any luck. Even though it's grown on me, I'll have to go back to Toyland. Just because, you know, years ago, that was not my favorite on the album. So. Toyland, little girls and boyland. And that's about the best I can do.
That was good. That was really good. That's gonna be so much better than mine. It's so funny. I'm definitely a tenor. Like anything lower than like an E or a D on the staff, and I have trouble with. So trying to do the baritone that is Leon Redbone is very hard. But for me, I picked, even though I really like the song, there's this one line in the song that it kind of reminds me of all those, you know, Santa from outer space things that I always find kind of odd. You know, I mean, as a kid, you know, Santa's in the North Pole. He's not in outer space. It has nothing to do with moonbeams or anything like that. So this is from That Old Christmas Moon. Even though I really love the song, I don't like this line here. And so let's see if I can do it. Santa's coming real soon, and the moonbeams will guide his sleigh. I don't, that was terrible. Yours is way better. But now I will leave it. I will leave it up to you, listeners, to vote, and I'll put that up on Twitter and Instagram and all that. And winner gets a sticker, unless I win, in which case I get nothing. But I think you're safe, Scott, because I have yet to win. So. Oh, man. But now that we're coming closer to the end, I got to ask, you know, G.I. Joe, they taught us that knowing was half the battle. What would you say is the other half?
I'd have to say a white suit and a Panama hat.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a good one. That's way better than mine. Mine was, so if knowing is half the battle, the other half is hiring the best studio musicians for your Tin Pan Alley-esque Christmas album.
Well, and that's going to win the day just about any time, at least in a musical setting.
You're right. Yeah. Oh, man. Scott, it's been a blast talking with you about this. I've enjoyed, you know, learning about Leon Redbone and this album in general and just, you know, some of the chord structures and things like that and inspirations. But, you know, what do you want to plug? Tell me about your show.
My show, Holly Jolly Xmasu, it's a podcast all about Japanese Christmas music. There's an album I was trying to find years ago. It took me 8 or 9 years to finally get it. Akira Ishikawa's Drum Christmas Drum. Good album, but it set me off down the path of finding all these other albums by artists who I had no clue who they were. I had no clue anything they'd done. And at the beginning of this year, I had a little Christmas money left over. I had done everything I could to find any way to get these songs online. Couldn't do it. So I finally bit the bullet. I ordered some vinyl from Japan. And those first four albums I got, just by luck, were fantastic. There were some great albums, and it really opened up this entire, literally an entire different world of Christmas music. So as the pandemic set in, you know, having a little extra time on my hand, I decided, you know, I had to do something to keep myself going. So I'd been listening to, you know, Can't Wait for Christmas, Christmas Past. And I figured, you know, I've got this music now, I've got the time. Why don't I go ahead and try doing a podcast about it? So I just finished editing my 8th episode. That'll be going live on Friday. I try to put them out the 25th of each month. And nice. You can find me on iTunes. Do a search on Google. You should be able to find my webpage. I'm on Facebook, Instagram. Yeah, so if you're looking for something a little bit different, if you want to hear some just fantastic music that you've literally never heard before, go ahead and check me out. As we get into the last few months of this year, I'm really pulling out some just phenomenal albums. A lot of it's jazz, but I've got some other really, really different stuff as well. So yeah, give it a listen, give me some feedback, let me know what you think, and if you like it, keep listening.
Yeah, and I definitely check it out. It's really cool. The Blue Comets one that you did.
Jackie Ishikawa and the Blue Comets, they're something else.
Yeah, that was pretty neat. I really enjoyed that one. So for sure, check it out. It's some great music. I mean, the harmonically, it's interesting. Melodically, it's interesting. I mean, just everything about it is something different. So if you're in that mood, I mean, go for it. It's really cool. So that's my plug for you.
Thank you.
I really enjoy it. I really do. As a musician, you know, it's nice to hear this kind of stuff and to know that people are still creative and all that. Although I know sometimes you have a little trouble acquiring some of this music. And so I always, whenever I hear one of your success stories, I always like kind of cheer to myself, like, yeah, we're going to hear something cool.
Yeah, well, and I've got one coming as soon as my friend's mother-in-law sends it. It sounds like it's going to be something fantastic. So looking forward to that. I've got a few other albums I just got that they're really going to add to what I'm putting out. So
right on.
Definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, I can't wait, man. It's great stuff. So keep it up. But on that note, I'm going to say thank you one more time for coming on. And I'm going to end it with, Christmas comes but once a year, and to me it brings good cheer. For checking us out on our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you're feeling like every day your Christmas dreams are coming true, leave us a review on iTunes. Not only does it help us reach more people, but you also get a free sticker. Now don't forget to vote. Later, dudes.